to call to order this meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. It's Friday, February 8th, 2013, and I'd like to welcome you all to this committee. We have a very interesting topic that we're going to be following today, and that is, you know, as you'll recall, those of you who were with us on the first day, one of the main themes that we're going to be following this session is strategies to enhance the affordability and access to higher education. And one of the strategies for getting there is efforts to revitalize our Oregon Opportunity Grant. And towards that end, I'm really excited and honored to welcome Treasurer Ted Wheeler to talk to us about plans that have been developed and are being worked out in a variety of ways for what's known as the Oregon Opportunity Initiative. So, Treasurer Wheeler, would you please come up and talk to us? Yes, and I will open an informational meeting on the Oregon Opportunity Initiative. Mike, you want to come up? Yeah.
Good morning, Chair Dembrow and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ted Wheeler. I'm the state treasurer. With me is Michael Savaggio, who works in the state treasury. First of all, Chair, thank you very much for the invitation to be here today to talk about the Oregon Opportunity Initiative. And furthermore, I want to thank you for your guidance and your leadership on this important issue. We will, of course, update you on the Opportunity Initiative itself, and we'll be happy to entertain any comments or questions that you might have at your leisure. By way of context, I want you to be aware that the State Treasury does have a regular role to play in higher education. We're the administrators of the 529 Oregon College Savings Plan. Michael Parker is here, who's the administrator of that program. So we spend a lot of time with students and their families discussing access and affordability. All of us in this room have spent a considerable amount of time talking about the Oregon economy and job creation, and most of our efforts have been focused on how do we bring jobs to Oregonians. The Opportunity Initiative flips that frame a little bit and talks about how do we bring Oregonians to the jobs? How do we ensure that they have the right skill set, the right training they need to be able to compete in the workforce both today and into the future? The Opportunity Initiative, in a nutshell, increases student aid to make higher education more accessible and affordable to Oregonians. It proposes to do so by creating a permanent and growing fund that's dedicated to student aid. It would be available to students who are currently eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, so that's students who are participating in community colleges, students who are seeking four-year degree programs. But this bill also has as a core goal to expand the reach to include vocational and technical training. All of us have had enough interactions with folks to know that there's a lot of young people in our state who do not necessarily want to get a four-year degree or even an associate's degree. They might want to work with their hands. On the flip side, we've all met with advanced manufacturers, healthcare concerns, technology employers who don't necessarily need folks with four-year degrees or associate's degrees, but they might need some level of technical training. Those jobs are available today in the state of Oregon. They are high-wage jobs, and they'll be even in higher demand going forward. So the Opportunity Initiative seeks to include vocational and technical training programs. Briefly on the need for this. Personally, I think the need is self-evident, but I want to walk through this anyway just in case people aren't familiar with all of these. And we could bury you in statistics, and I won't do that. There is a handout that Michael will provide to all of you that has statistics that are all sourced for those of you who are interested in PolitiFact conversations. First, the cost of higher education in the state of Oregon is high. and it's growing. The cost to students is high, and it's growing. In fact, the cost to students in higher education, for higher education in Oregon, is about 18% higher than the national average. It's growing rapidly. Between the years 2004 and 2012, the cost to students of higher education in Oregon went up 50%. Meanwhile, student aid in the state of Oregon is relatively anemic. The aid available to students, both through the Opportunity Grant Program and at the institutions themselves, is about 20% less than the national average. In fact, only 2 out of 10 students who currently qualify for the Oregon Opportunity Grant receive any funding at all. And that's just because there aren't enough resources in that program to support need beyond 2 out of 10 students. We all know about the issue of student debt. It's a significant issue nationally. It's a significant issue here in the state of Oregon. Nationally, that debt is pegged at somewhere in the $1 trillion range. According to many sources, student debt now exceeds personal credit card debt in the United States. Make no mistake about it, that is an anchor on the next generation's economic prospects. Here in the state of Oregon, over a 5-year period ending in 2010, which is the last year for which we have data, student debt increased 21% just in that time period. The reason the business community is so interested in this particular issue is there is a significant impact, of course, on our community and our economy. We know that those who participate in higher education programs have higher employment and higher income levels across the board. We have some charts we could certainly show you if you'd like to see that visualized. On the other hand, the benefits are fairly obvious. This will help students and their families afford higher education. It'll help reduce student debt, and in part that's why this has been endorsed by the Oregon Student Association and the Oregon Community College Student Association. This will help grow the Oregon economy by connecting the folks in our state with the skills and the tools they need to be able to compete in the modern economy, and it'll help grow Oregon's per capita wages. And that's been an issue we've all been wrestling with for a number of years. That's why this is endorsed by the Oregon Business Association and why higher education access and affordability is a key component of the Oregon business plan. There's also some not so obvious benefits to this that I'd just like to briefly bullet point for you. The question that most often comes up is, can we afford this? And as you struggle with that question, I hope you'll also consider that those who participate in the state of Oregon in higher education experiences draw less on costly social service programs. They have better health care outcomes and have reduced public health interactions, and they also have fewer public safety interactions. So potentially there's some cost savings to be had in terms of other government programs. This is also part of the answer of how we achieve and how we pay for the 40-40-20 higher education goals, which of course you're all very familiar with. So how does this all work? The proposal is that we issue general obligation debt in two tranches, two $250 million tranches. The proceeds of that debt issuance are then invested. The proceeds of that investment go towards the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program and towards the development of a permanent growing fund dedicated towards higher education access and affordability. In the near term, meaning after the bonds are issued, this would increase the proceeds going into the Opportunity Grant Program by about 50%. That's the short-term ask, but I want to be transparent. What we're trying to do here is lay out a longer-term vision. If the legislature does what students, their families, and the business community is asking us to do, this is a long-term commitment to higher education access and affordability. And we've laid out a vision The vision could work in different ways, but one vision that we've laid out is a 30-year vision, 15 biennia, whereby there are decreasing contributions by the legislature to this fund. At the end of 30 years, we would basically have a $6 billion permanent endowment for higher education access and affordability. And there's different ways we could look at it, but the bottom line is it's creating a permanent asset that would be a competitive advantage for the state of Oregon. Instead of the legislature every year into perpetuity for the next 100 years or however long taking general fund dollars and determining how much goes into student aid, this fund becomes self-supporting. It becomes a permanent asset, something that the state of Oregon can look to as a competitive advantage. The bill suggests, it's not directive, but it suggests how we should look at how the funds are used. It's been a while since we looked at how the opportunity grant funds are distributed, how they're used. We want to make sure that those resources are being used in the best manner possible. So the bill asks the administrators of the program to look at incentives for critical degrees and STEM programs, science, technology, engineering, and math programs. It encourages incentivization of vocational and technical training programs and looking at some of the best partnerships that currently exist out there in the state today, and there's many excellent examples. And finally, it also asks the administrators to look at incentives for helping students to graduate on time. You'll hear from the university system in particular that there are withering infrastructure and capacity needs. Part of the answer of how we reduce the cost of education is throughput. Can we get young people to go through the programs in a more timely basis, freeing up capacity for other students? And is there a way to appropriately incentivize that? In conclusion, I would just say this is part of a pool of higher education proposals that are going to be in front of you this year. You're all aware about the governance issues, there's cost control issues, there's workforce development issues, capacity and infrastructure issues, and we see this as a part of a larger package of higher education initiatives, but we see the access and affordability piece as a very important component of that overall discussion, and that's why we're asking for your support. Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, I want to thank you for having us here today, and of course we'll entertain any thoughts you have or any questions you may have to the best of our ability.
Yes, Representative Greenlee.
Thank you. Ted, I haven't studied this in detail, but were you at the 10,000 foot level, explain, we're going to borrow money, we're going to invest the money we borrow, and then we're going to also pay off that debt over time. Is the investment going to be used to pay off the money, or is general funds that might otherwise have gone into the fund used to pay off?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Chair Dembrough, Representative Greenlee, and members of the committee. I'm going to let Michael answer that because he's put together the short answer is there are different ways that we could do it, and we've laid out one vision, and I'll let Michael talk about that.
Here. Do we have a copy of the plan or a bill, or what do we have? I don't see anything. I appreciate the treasurer's testimony.
Yes. This is embedded in House Joint Resolution 6, and Mike will explain it, I think. There are actually a couple of parts to this. Michael, introduce yourself and talk to us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio from the State Treasurer's Office. Very briefly, the measure before you, House Joint Resolution 6, is, I believe, identical to Senate Joint Resolution 1. Either of those being referred out, plus Senate Bill 11, would be the statutory bulk of this measure. There's additional details at a website that we've set up at OregonOpportunityInitiative.com too many materials, I think, to put before you at this time, but various handouts that you can look over, and I will be happy to personally deliver a packet to the members of this committee and to the committee administrator. Mr. Chair, to Representative Grunlich's question about how exactly the debt service is worked out, we are anticipating issuing these bonds as general obligation bonds, which is what requires the referral out to create a new general obligation bond category called Article 11P. I mean, R, I beg your pardon, Article 11R. And
P was already taken.
P was already taken. Strangely enough, the letter C is not taken, and yet we've been told that we can't have that.
Mike, just before you go on, so we need to amend the Constitution because currently we can only bond for physical infrastructure, right? And this is, you know, as I've been saying, this is investing in human infrastructure. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a little bit broader than that, actually. That is correct, but in fact, the Constitution does not allow us to bond beyond beyond $50,000 for any use that's not specifically carved out. So regardless of whether it's physical infrastructure or our financial asset, we need a specific carve-out for that particular use. And to Representative Grunlich's question about how the bonds are paid, so we would establish the Article 11R general obligation ability and issue these bonds as general obligation bonds that ordinarily are paid back through the general fund debt capacity. And it is our understanding that that would be how the bonds would be paid back. However, we do allow in the measure for the earnings in the fund itself to also contribute to that debt service. So once the fund is of size, it becomes at the direction of the legislature, how much of those earnings do you want to use in debt service and how much of the earnings do you want to flow into student assistance. Our projections do not anticipate that the earnings would flow into debt service simply because that cuts into the actual objective of the measure. However, just to give you a kind of a point on that, the issuing the first $500 million obligates the state to a certain amount of debt service from whatever source and begins generating about $25 million in the first year of revenue flowing into the Opportunity Grant Program. That number increases over time as the debt service stays stable. So after about 12 years, the debt service is outpaced by the additional revenue. At that time,
what return rate is this issue?
We're anticipating, we're projecting, I should say, a 7% return rate, average of 5.5% interest rate over the next 30 years. And clearly we're trying to make projections over a 30-year period, so the only promise that I can make to the committee is that those projections will not be spot on. And to elaborate slightly on that, so at that point the legislature may decide to pay all or a portion of that debt service with the earnings, but again, that would cut into student assistance. We would hope that all of that money would flow into student assistance as it's within our prudent debt capacity to do to issue these bonds.
Thanks, Mike. Rep Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Treasurer Wheeler and staff. Appreciate your work on this. I've always been very supportive of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The concept's intriguing, and I'll be anxious to get Michael's information and read more about it. I do have some concerns, though. We're on the higher ed committee looking at delving into a lot of areas this session, and one of those that I've been concerned about, oftentimes if we do enterprise zone things or offsets, grants, whatever, we've got clawbacks for companies. And I would like to get down to a number that how much opportunity grant has gone to students that has ended up with no degree, no completion, you know, very little education to show for educating up, skilling up to get them into a better job. I've got a concern that maybe too much the opportunity grant has not been invested, but it's just been kind of thrown out there to see what'll stick, and not enough of it sticking. And I could be wrong, and I'd love for somebody to prove me wrong, but I don't think I am. That's a big concern. The other thing, the area that we're looking at is in the advising category. Wouldn't have anything to do with you, but it's work that we're going to be looking at with higher ed this session and asking, because I hear from a lot of students that say, you know, I was ill-advised when I went to the institution, tried to find out specifically what classes I need to take, what the degree program entailed. You know, they've taken classes and paid for classes that they didn't need. Were they paid for with the opportunity grant? And a trigonometry class that was supposed to be a part of a degree program that wasn't needed, was that class paid for with the opportunity grant, or is the student carrying a loan that now they're having to pay for a class that wasn't necessary but they were told it was? So we're looking at advising. Do we need more advisors, and are entering students getting enough of the right information that they need? So there are some things we're working on that is almost a cart and a horse thing.
So
for me,
let me just jump in there. Rep Huffman. Rep Huffman is a great student, and you know, today's class is on our Higher Ed 101 today is on the OSAC, the Oregon Student Access Commission. So at the end of in the latter part of today's class, I'm sorry, today's hearing, we're going to be hearing from the OSAC director, and I believe that we. You know, coming out of recommendations that were made by the Student Success Task Force last year was, you know, we want OSAC to be looking at that very question of, you know, what is the success rate of students who are getting the opportunity grant versus those who are not getting the opportunity grant? There are a number of factors involved, but, you know, I think that, you know, as the Treasurer said earlier, you know, inherent in this process is going to be us, OSAC and us, taking a hard look at the opportunity grant and making sure that these investments really do lead to success.
Is this class going to give us a certificate that can move us up in the 40-40
professional
certificate? I'm trying to get, I am trying to get to make this an accredited committee.
And it's going to be on the test, is the other question.
Well, I'm not telling you that.
Chair Denver, may I respond to Representative Huffman's comment?
Yes, please, Ms. Wheeler.
And you got it exactly right, Representative Huffman, through Chair Jembro. You're hitting on a very key issue. And I want to be very clear what this bill does versus what it does not do. We were advised not to suggest how best to spend the opportunity grant dollars, because we were advised that the legislature and the governor's team, Rudy Crewe and others, were taking a hard look at whether or not we have the right structure for the opportunity grant program, whether we were getting the bang for the buck. And I will just relate to you, not a week ago, we were at Central Oregon Community College meeting with a group of students who are interested in this particular issue, and this very issue was raised by a young woman who did not get, she was one of the 8 out of 10 who applied but did not get access to the Opportunity Grant Program, and she was apoplectic that she knew other people who did get those dollars and they were not using them. So, you know, basically they were AWOL. So I just want you to know, you know, anecdotally, what you're suggesting definitely deserves a look. We have limited dollars here. We're a resource-constrained state, and we need to make sure that those dollars are, in fact, delivering the kind of results we want. So we're encouraging that broad look, but we do not presuppose the outcomes in this particular bill. We're creating the structure, we're creating a source of financing, and we're leaving it to the higher education experts to determine how best to use these dollars and ensure that they're being used wisely.
Thank you. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Treasurer, for your work on this. And I'm going to address the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And as we talk about affordability and access, obviously cost constraints and the cost of higher ed, you referenced how it's gone up 50% over the past number of years and so forth, while state aid is not kept up with that. You referenced the Oregon Business Plan, which talks about investing in education and so forth, and I totally agree with that. But one of the bullet points on the Oregon Business Plan was also fixed PERS. Jay Kent prepared a little report for me last fall that said that over the past two biennium, 2011-13 and 2013-15, the cost of PERS to the OUS system will be $152 million over that time frame. That cost is being borne by students. It's being put into tuition rates and so forth. So all that to say, I think you're going to find, and I think you would agree with me, that there will be greater support in this building and there will be greater support at the ballot box if, in fact, there is some serious work done in trying to reform that cost driver that is increasing, being borne by our students to a large extent, which is resulting in that debt that they now take with them as they try to go on into their lives and be productive citizens and so forth. So yeah. I would just like your comments on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Representative Johnson through Chair Dembro. As I stated at the beginning, this is a piece of a larger package of proposals around higher education. And cost containment is, of course, one of those key issues. And I'm making an assumption here, and it may be a wrong assumption, and it's not really my place to presume even the answer. But I'm assuming as the piece gets to you about governance issues, the cost control issue is going to come into the discussion in the context of that conversation. That's my guess and my supposition. But we understand that this bill in and of itself, other than some of the incentives that we've suggested, other than the fact that people participating in the higher education system have a lower burden on public resources, we are assuming that that discussion of cost containment will be raised at some point in the conversation of all of these higher education bills.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
And I will just remind everyone that, you know, we also heard from Jay Kenton that the higher ed, the universities, and also we know the community colleges, have kept their cost per student stable over the last 20 years. The cost per student has not gone up since the 90s. What has gone up has been tuition, and the reason tuition has gone up is because the state investment has gone steadily down. That's the connection that we can point to. Rep. Gallegos?
Yeah, thank you, Treasurer. I just had a question maybe you can help me to understand. When I was in school, we had this notion that they were purposely keeping this longer than we needed to be there. So you mentioned earlier how the universities were interested in graduating students, getting them through timely fashion. I guess I'm just trying to think how that works. I'm assuming that it's because upper division classes are smaller and lower division courses would have larger numbers of students. Therefore, the lower division courses are more productive in terms of cost. Is that sort of your thinking?
Representative Galgos through Chair Dembro, that could certainly be part of it. I believe a larger part, and again, this is more anecdotal than fact-based, in our conversations with students, what struck me is different between the students today versus when we were in the higher education system is that because the cost to them is higher, and because of the debt issue being a significant factor for them, they're working more. I had a young woman in one of our recent meetings with students, I believe it was at the University of Oregon several weeks ago, where not only is, actually it was at one of the community colleges, not only is she a mother, she was holding down two jobs while getting a community college certificate.
So part of it is what used to take 4 years for a degree program, for example, where you could focus exclusively on that program, understanding you would get some degree of student aid, the cost would be substantially lower in real dollars, and your debt on the outside would be substantially less in real dollars. You wouldn't necessarily have to hold down two jobs, you might have to hold down one. So students that would have taken 4 years are now taking 5 years or even 6 years. The consequence of that is twofold. Number one, it means the cost to the students is higher. Potentially, it means they have more debt, and it means that there's a seat in a classroom that is being taken up by one person for 6 years instead of four. So it's a, you can either build a new factory or you can increase throughput. And so getting at one of Representative Johnson's questions about cost, throughput is another way of reducing cost. So if we can provide more student aid, the question we have is, does that increase throughput and reduce the cost per student even greater?
Thank you.
That was a long answer. Did that even help?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I do think that was very helpful, Treasurer. And the, you know, the other problem, the longer students are in school, the greater the risk that they will drop out. Something will come up, they'll drop out and won't ever come back and won't, you know, complete their goals. And that's a huge problem that we're seeing across the nation. Okay, Rep. Wisnett, and then I have a couple.
Thank you. Mr. Treasurer, $6 billion, how does that compare to other state endowments, state universities? And you're the expert, I turn to you for advice. How much of our indebtedness is this leaving us with, and what's that taking off the table? And then I'd like to ask the chair a question.
Yes, Representative Whitson through Chair Dembro. I don't have an answer to your first question in terms of how would this compare to other states. I would comment that the $6 billion number, that assumes that over the next 15 biennia, the legislature does what we sort of hypothesized as one path that could take place over 30 years. We are most certainly asking for the two $250 million tranches in this legislative session. We're not presuming what future legislators will do, but we are laying out a vision that we think is realistic for a 30-year, or three-decade proposal that would get you to that $6 billion number. With regard to debt capacity, that is a real issue. There is about $910 million available in this legislative session for general obligation debt. It doesn't include lottery or taxpayer-supported debt for transportation or economic development or anything like that. But this would take a little over half of the existing capacity, about $500 million of the $910 million in capacity that's available to you as a legislature this session, assuming you want to stay under our conservative 5% servicing limit, which I would encourage you to do as the state treasurer.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
You know, this is the big thing of going to the voters. Are we going to see SB 11, or will that go from the Senate committee to Ways and Means, and we'll not get to see that? Because I don't know how we can really vote on House Joint Resolution 6 without knowing what Senate bill the implementation would be or something, which is in SB 11, I'm understanding. And also, I appreciate the treasurer, but I probably have to get a lot of advice and my tax accountant to explain all this to me, so I understand it a little better. And I'm sure the treasurer.
Yes, sir. If you'd like to meet with us separately, we're obviously happy to do that.
Yes, thank you. Just in response to your question, Representative, which is a very good one. You know, we will, you know, have to have some conversations with our Senate partners about the trajectory to make sure that before we vote on HJR 6, that we understand what's happening with the other bill. And I think there's a parallel vehicle, is there not, for the constitutional referral on the Senate side? So we'll have to get that worked out. But this is such an important issue. We want to get this on the table, you know, right here, week one. Yes, Mike.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just for the record, so there's no confusion, the measure before you is not going to bind any future legislature to additional deposits. The constitutional piece simply sets up the financial framework. The statutory piece this session would authorize that $500 million worth of bonding. Past that, even though we have some projections of what that could look like over the next 15 biennia, there's nothing in the constitutional piece or the statutory piece that is going to require a particular legislature to make those commitments. So we leave that to the priorities of each session.
Right. And along those lines, actually, that leads to a couple of questions that I have. You know, one is that constitutional referral will create the framework to allow a program like the Opportunity Initiative to work. But, you know, we've also, there may be some other ideas out there that could also be part of, that could also be funded through this program. We heard, and we will be having a hearing on a proposal called the Pay It Forward proposal, which is looking at tuition in a different way. That, too, is going to need upfront money because in some ways it's like a loan program where the loan would be paid back over time. We would need to do bonding to have the startup money to loan, and then it would be returned back. And, you know, there's another proposal I've heard that would actually create a state loan program similar to the federal student loan program, having a state loan program. You know, if we were to look at the merits of that and there were merits, then we might want to include that in this framework to be funded through the endowment.
Yes,
does that make sense?
Yes, Chair Dembrough, if I may, and members of the committee, it absolutely makes sense. In a sense, those are plug-and-play opportunities with this, and that's why we created the structure and the financing mechanism that didn't jump over the wall in terms of how those resources are best used. You know, conceptually, if the people who are administering the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program wanted to change it from a grant to a loan program or focus the resources in a different direction, you know, we're not getting into that discussion. We're leaving that up to the experts and the people who are studying those particular issues. So the answer is yes, that could absolutely be done with this construct.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I assume it's boilerplate, but it talks about never exceeding 1% of the real value of the property of the state or something. How do you know what that is, and how do you deal with that limitation when the real property value changes significantly like it has in the last few years?
Oh, you baby. Great.
Chair Denver, members of the committee, I really wish I wrote this down on my cheat sheet because our debt manager, Laura Lachlan McCall, did in fact give me the number of what 1% of the total real property value of the state is. It tends to top out somewhere in the tens of billions, and then if you add up, I mean the 1% figure, not the total. The total value is obviously larger than that.
We would do it though, is that right? I mean, this is pro forma, or is it a real limitation?
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, that is a pro forma addition, and it's one of those elements that you're going to, if you read through all those debt carve-outs in the Constitution, you'll find that they each have some limit in there. There's the initial $50,000, which I'm sure must have seemed astronomical in 1859, and then I think we got a little smarter and decided, well, we're just going to actually peg this to property value, but I think if you total them all up, it's not even 10%. So it's kept at a nice small number that is still far, far beyond what we actually bond. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you're welcome. You know, one of the attractive features of this for me is the potential for this endowment fund to attract outside contributions, right? And you know, philanthropy coming to help increase the rate of increase of this fund. That would be possible, would it not?
Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, yes, that would absolutely be possible. We've drafted the constitutional amendment specifically to allow for that kind of deposit into the fund.
And the reason that's attractive to me is I know there are a lot of people that want to contribute philanthropically to their alma mater or to a particular university. But then there are others who are just, you know, committed to supporting higher education in Oregon in general, community college, university, et cetera. And it seems to me that if, you know, if marketed appropriately, this fund could do that. Anyone could contribute to the fund and feel confident, certainly once we've taken a close look at the Opportunity Grant Program, feel confident that that would go to the neediest students who, you know, to close that opportunity grant, that opportunity gap, actually, that we face as a state. So I'd like to hear your thoughts about that, Treasurer.
So in the legislation that we pass, whether it's this or whether it's the Oregon Investment Act, we're always looking for leverage. I mean, the reality is I don't think I'm shocking anybody if I say again that we are a resource-constrained state, and we will probably be a resource-constrained state for the foreseeable future. So anytime we can find a way to leverage private sector dollars from community-minded institutions or foundations that are interested in helping support these particular goals, as long as we're going through the effort to create the structure that enables them to do so, why would we not accept those resources? It's, you know, government here is filling a gap, but it's my hope that with time we can encourage other institutions in the private sector to either help us fill that gap or potentially and hopefully someday take the lead. So we want to create that structure sooner rather than later.
Other questions at this time? Yes, Rick Johnson.
Mr. Chair, question for you. What are your plans for working this HDR 6? Will we have opportunities to make amendments?
Oh, sure. I don't think we're going to be working this really quickly. Not until we really have an understanding of what's happening on the other side.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, Chair Dembrough. Thank you, members of the committee.
Great. Okay, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the Opportunity Initiative, and I would like to open concurrent public hearings on HJR 6, HB 2299, and HB 2304. And these different bills have one thing in common, and that is Rep. Reed. So, Representative Reed, would you please come forward? And I know you're on kind of a tight timeline, so tell us how you think we should handle this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27. I would not presume to tell you how to handle your own committee, but the Treasurer and I are both on the Oregon Growth Board, which meets at 9 o'clock, so when you're finished with me, I will head over to that meeting. Appreciate opening the hearings concurrently. What I might propose is to just make a couple of quick comments about the bills. Michael Parker, the Executive Director of the 529 Network, is here to answer questions, particularly about House Bill 2299, and I'm happy to answer any of your questions as well, if that's acceptable.
That's
so
great.
Great. So I'm happy to be following the Treasurer and very supportive of the Opportunity Initiative. What you are receiving is a few graphs from two different sources, one the College Savings Plan, the other from the excellent Office of Economic Analysis, with which we are very familiar in the Revenue Committee.
both of which, I think, or all of which serve to really underscore the importance and effectiveness of saving for higher education and success in higher education in terms of employment and wages. So both of these bills are, I think, additional tools to support Oregonians who are headed that direction. And just to take them briefly in order, House Bill 2299 is a very simple concept. We know how important saving early for college is and what an effect that has. In fact, the state has decided to incent that by offering a tax advantage for those who choose to do it through the 529 network. And what this bill does is ask the health authority to once a quarter send the names and addresses of new parents to the 529 network so that they can let those parents know about how the 529 network does. You can look at it as an innovative way to help Oregonians take advantage of a program we've already enacted, or alternatively, you can look at it as an efficiency measure, because the Ways and Means Committee evaluates the 529 network based on how many accounts are open within the network. So this is another way to make that more efficient and effective. The 529 network has been very involved in the construction of the bill. I think they're prepared, I won't speak for them, but I think they're prepared to implement it in a way that would help Oregonians get started. So I'll leave the details on that to Michael. House Bill 2304 has to do with I think it's a nice complement to the Opportunity Initiative, which is intended to help people get started. This modest tax credit, and I say that deliberately, is intended to help people finish. It would be a tax credit available only to people who finish degrees or certificates, and obviously it's only available if they have done that and remained in Oregon. So despite its very modest size, I think it could have a significant effect. We spent a lot of time talking with admissions officers around the state and students and parents. The two populations that I think this could be important for are students who are clearly going to go to college. The question is whether they do so in Oregon or somewhere else. And the other is the population of students who might not go to college, for whom a little bit of an incentive, a little bit of something at the end. If we can say, here's a little bit of help, if you can finish, if you can get your degree, this can help. So I think I'm sure there are others who will say to you, this doesn't matter, it's too small. I think the data that's in front of you in these graphs show how important higher education is for the state and for individual Oregonians, and we should not be afraid to try modest approaches in various forms. So I'm happy to answer questions. I appreciate you having a hearing, and eager to help.
Yes, Rep. Reed, could you explain a little more just how House Bill 2304 would work, in terms of, incentivizing completion and just the mechanics of it? A person could not claim the credit until they had completed, and then they would claim it for a number of years. Is that how it works?
That's correct. We started, Mr. Chair, when I began this concept, I talked with admissions officers and asked them, what do you think would make a difference? And their answer generally was something very simple. So we started with the idea of saying, if you get a bachelor's degree, we want to give you $1,000 credit. That's a simple number. It's an easy thing to understand. And then we started breaking that down in terms of the mechanics and working with the Department of Revenue. So we ended up with, it's a rough sort of maybe a little crude approach, but turning that into $125 a year at community colleges and $250 a year at four-year institutions. So the bill provides for the scenarios where someone earns a community college degree, where someone earns a bachelor's degree, or someone earns an associate's degree and then a bachelor's degree. All those scenarios are provided for in the bill. And yes, once the degree is earned, the credit is available. But of course, it's only available if they stay in Oregon and have income tax. It's also worth noting that it's a non-refundable credit and that it has a sunset on it. So we can evaluate whether it makes any difference.
Mm-hmm. And so would it be a one-time credit? of 125 and 250
per year. So Mr. Chair, if a person earns an associate's degree at a community college, it's $125 per year, so that there would be a $250 credit. And if they earn a bachelor's degree all 4 years at a four-year institution, it would be $1,000. If it's 2 years and 2 years, then the combination of those two.
Okay. And again, why not just give a $250 bonus, as it were, you know, for completing the associates, and a $500 or, you know, whatever the total would be at, you know, in at one time? Wouldn't that just be simpler?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand. I think I would certainly be open to alternatives. The point that is important for me, I think, is that this is at the end rather than at the beginning. But I'm certainly open to alternatives on that bonus at the completion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Representative. Your recommendation, you set up another bureaucracy. Here you're using Department of Revenue and just putting on your taxes. But to the issue of
well, it'd still be the taxes, but if you... You know, let's say you completed
taxes,
your associate.
There's no bonus in your tax. There's no thing where you get a bonus.
No, but the tax credit would, in effect, be a bonus, a reward, as it were. If you complete your degree.
It's going to be a payment or debt.
Well, yes. No, I understand. It's a tax credit. But you're envisioning the $250 for the associate's degree would then be spread out, 125 1 year, 125 another as a credit?
It could be, and I'm certainly open to those possibilities. It is really a question of what the revenue appetite is, and I bring this proposal very carefully, because as a longtime member of the House Revenue Committee, I spent a lot of time on tax credits. I think this is a different sort of tax credit, because I think you can argue it has a very positive, almost paying for itself effect when people who have those degrees are much more likely to be employed and at much higher wages. I think that's different.
Mr. Chair, I don't think he's opposing what you said. I think at the end of 2 years, and you've completed a certificate, the next time you file Oregon income tax, you get the $250 credit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, that's correct.
Okay.
And that's good, because that means they're in Oregon because they're paying Oregon income tax. Can I ask
two questions?
First, I generally vote against all tax credits unless there's an offsetting one. You have a nice little one that would match this, eliminate, that would go along so there wouldn't be a fiscal...
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I have lots of ideas about tax credits and tax expenditures that ought to be modified or eliminated. I don't have it connected with this one today.
And the other question is, the other bill, I think we've had that bill before us before, but it's failed. Why has it failed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee,
it's so obvious to me.
Your memory is excellent. In the 2011 session in your health care committee, we passed the bill. I think it started there because of the health authority. It went to Ways and Means in that environment where we were operating that had anything that had even a dollar associated with it went to Ways and Means.
It's about a $9 fiscal or something.
It was something of that order, I think. So I appreciate your comments. I think it would be a very good thing to pass.
And just to follow on that, Rep. Reed, last time we had a tax credit bill back in 2011 that you sponsored, but that one wasn't tied to completion in this way, was it? Or was it?
Mr. Chair, I don't recall doing a tax credit related to education that other than this one.
Okay.
I could certainly be forgetting something, but my interest in tax credits associated with education has always been in tying it to completion.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Rep.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Reed, would a taxpayer have to actually owe tax to the state of Oregon in order to reap these benefits, or could it result in a net check from the state if you didn't, in fact, have any taxable, you know, liability in that tax year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I think what you're asking is whether it's a refundable credit or a non-refundable credit. The current version is non-refundable, but I'm certainly open to that possibility. It is simply a question of what the revenue impact would be and what our collective appetite is for that.
Well, it can only be used to offset existing tax burdens by the taxpayer, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, in its current form, that's correct.
Okay. Follow-up?
Yes. Representative
Johnson. We just heard a long discussion about debt incurred by students and so forth, and I wondered if you'd considered making this potential benefit simply applied to retiring debt incurred while the actual student was in pursuit of his or her certificate or degree.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it's an interesting question. I had not thought about that. I think for me, the key concept here is that it is an incentive to finish, that it's there and available after completion. I don't know what the mechanics would be around limiting the ways it could be used, but I imagine if I'm in that spot, and I am in that spot, still paying student loans, if I got that opportunity, that would be among the first things I'd want to put it toward.
I take it to a casino and try it.
Well, correct. I can just see it ending up in a flat screen on somebody's wall. But if we're serious about helping students and access, anyway, just not sidelight.
I understand. Thank you.
Rep Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep Reed, how many students did you talk to see if this would incent them complete a degree? Was $125 per year enough of a carrot? Because if it's not, then it's not an incentive. It ends up just being a gift at the end.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, I could not claim that I have a statistically valid sample by any stretch. This is not the first time I've brought this concept. So it has my conversations might even be a little bit dated, but I talked to probably a couple of dozen students, and I don't think any of them would say, "Oh yeah, this is going to make all the difference in the world for me. Now I can afford to go to college." But again, I think the target is really those two populations for whom this could introduce other possibilities. Maybe it's the tipping point for someone. Maybe it causes them to look at other possibilities. I'm not before you suggesting that this is the key to achieving our 40-40-20 goals, but I am suggesting that since that's so important, it's worth trying things like this. And again, it's a modest revenue impact. It has a sunset. If it doesn't work, we can adjust it. We can end it. I think clearly, if we have the capacity to do greater numbers, it would likely have a greater effect.
And let me clarify, colleagues, that this bill has a subsequent referral to revenue, and that's where it would be looked at side by side with all the other credits and you know, tax expenditures that we do to see if we have a limited capacity to do tax expenditures, is this one that should be on the list?
And Mr. Chair, if it gets that far, that might be the opportunity to respond more specifically to Representative Greenlick's question about pairing with other with other tax expenditures.
Yes, that's right. What our job is, I think, is to look at the policy implications of this program, and questions such as how do we feel about tying such a program to completion, which is a change. This would be open to the general population, not just those of greatest need, right? As the Opportunity Grant does. How do we feel about that? How do we feel about the fact that it sort of incentivizes students who graduate to stay in state? I don't know that anybody's going to stay in state in order to get their tax credit alone, but it does reward them, in a sense, for staying in state and working, which is what we definitely want to see happen with our graduates. So those are all things for us to ponder, and I'll be circling back with all of you and get your thoughts on this bill, and we'll talk about perhaps modifying it and whether or not we want to send it to a work session.
Mr. Chair, may I suggest that you might, the committee might benefit from hearing from Mr. Parker about the details on House Bill 2299 if you're finished with House Bill 23.
Oh, yes. No, absolutely. Sure, yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. Happy to be here today to support House Bill 2299. As you are probably aware, the Oregon College Savings Plan and the network has been around for about 12 years now. We have about $1.8 billion in assets in our plans. We have two plans that operate right now. And our main public policy, as you've heard today, is to get more families and more kids into college. And 2299, I think, would help achieve that goal. Just kind of one statistic of a study that I've seen recently is that kids with a college savings account in their name are much more likely to attend college. And then those kids who have a college savings plan in their name for a longer period of time, the families are going to incur much less debt, as you heard from the Treasurer today, on the debt load. So really our goal at the network is to get more kids in this state with a plan in their name and to have that money flow into those accounts. In relation to 2299, a relatively simple bill, we do a ton of public education awareness around the state all year with our programs, talking to parents, talking to families. This would just be another arrow in our quiver to be able to talk with parents about the benefits, one, of getting a college education for your kids, but also the need to really plan for it. I think that's really the critical piece here is that, you know, when I was in school, when we're all in school, it was almost a pay-as-you-go system. Now you really have to plan for that education. This gives us the opportunity to talk with parents about that process, what it takes to plan for it. It's a great time, too, because a kid is young, and so the planning is much easier to do when that kid is one or two as opposed to when they're 10 or 12. As far as implementation goes, we are prepared to implement 2299 and get those get the information out to parents every quarter as the bill states. So that's really my prepared testimony. Happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Mr. Chair, I might also add, Representative Greenlick recalls a fiscal from the last experience with this. We don't have a fiscal impact statement for this bill. I think in the last go around, the 529 network was prepared to absorb those costs from within their own resources. And I hope if there is a fiscal impact statement on this bill, that the same would be the case.
Mr. Chair, can I comment on that? It shouldn't have fiscal. It's just a run. They do it. They do reports all the time. And it's doing 4 reports a year inside their existing system. So it's crazy to have a fiscal. And there is none.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I'm saying I don't think we have one. We have not received a statement yet for this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, we haven't received the need for a fiscal. As far as the 529 network is concerned, it would be minimal. We would just absorb it in our normal education program. I can't speak to vital records, but as far as we're concerned, the mailings that we'll do will just be absorbed within our current program.
Can I deliver some vital records?
Oh, yes, please. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you. I'm Jennifer Woodward from Vital Records. Thank you, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. As far as the fiscal on this bill, it is the same fiscal as we had in the 2011 session, and it's a one-time fiscal just to set up the data file, the birth file, to send to the Treasury Department, and we would do it automatically quarterly. So it is a small fiscal.
Okay. Meaning what?
Last session, it was about $8,000.
Okay. And again, Mr. Parker, your sense is that's something you could absorb.
Yeah. Chair Dembo, members of the committee, we would absorb that $8,000 to set this up because we think it's a great idea as part of our continuing education program with parents. So we would pay the $8,000 to set this up and then move from there.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for coming up. Okay. Thank you, Representative.
What did he say? Did you say you'd pay the fiscal?
Chair Denver, Representative Greenlick, the college savings plan thinks this is a good idea, wants to be able to have this conversation with parents of young kids. So we've agreed, as we did last session, to absorb the $8,000 within our budget and get this program started.
So it should have a zero fiscal then, is that right?
My understanding, Chair Denbro, Representative Woodley, how fiscals work is even if there is a minimal impact, like obviously we're going to have mailing costs and that kind of thing, it would be minimal. So that's how we would code this as a minimal fiscal. But again, that's absorbed within our current budget.
Yes. Are you trying to get them to pick up some other costs?
No, I'm just trying to figure out how it's going to come through, whether it's going to come through as an $8,000 fiscal or whether it's going to come through as a minimum fiscal. When in fact, it's you're willing to pay the $8,000. I think it's crazy to kill this thing by having a fiscal and setting the ways and means, and my preference would be to get rid of a fiscal and then rescind the ways and means referral.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, it does not have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means currently.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, it doesn't have a subsequent referral.
That's kind of got hung up that way. Indeed. That's why I'm sorry.
Mr. Yes. Chair. I think we could probably, given what we know, keep it from being, a decision made to refer it to Ways and Means. Thank you. Thanks for bringing that up. Okay, thank you, panel.
Thank you.
And, why don't we have some people who've signed up to speak to all three of these bills. Why don't we, since we've just been talking about 2299, go to that one. And we have Jody Weiser.
Good morning to the committee. I'm Jody Weiser, and I'm here representing Tax Fairness Oregon, which is a group of people that we interact with online, and about 10 of us are now meeting weekly to discuss the work you're doing and come up with our ideas. And so this is our response to House Bill 2299. We think this is an extremely well-crafted bill in terms of thinking of all the considerations. And we would think it would be a good idea if we thought it might truly increase the participation of people in the college savings plans to a wider demographic than it currently reaches. But we don't have any evidence from another state that it does, that this kind of idea would. And so is it really something that we should take on? If we were flush again, then we might say, yeah, we should go ahead and try it. However, at the present time, whenever I hear an ad for the 529 plan, I know that everyone who responds to it is going to actually reduce the money we have available in the general fund, which means we're going to reduce our basic funding for college education or for the Oregon Opportunity Grant or some other core service. And so when I hear those ads, I wonder, why are we trying to reduce the general fund? And why don't we have Michael Parker doing something else with his time that would be more beneficial to the state while we're in a crisis? The cost of the 529 plan to our tax system is not fully known. If you look in the tax expenditure book, it includes about $16.3 million for the coming biennium in the tax advantage that participants get when they put money into the fund. But the 529 plan is actually like having a regular traditional IRA and a Roth IRA combined. So the money that goes in that's below the current level of, I didn't memorize the number, 4,300 and something, I believe, that a couple can put in, that's tax advantaged. You can put more than that in, but that part is tax advantaged. All of the growth, all of the capital gains are also tax advantaged. And the tax expenditure report is not reporting that those capital gains. And so it's really more costly than this, which wouldn't be such a problem if it were used as broadly as the Oregon Opportunity Grant program. But it's not. In fact, 86% of the dollars of the money going in goes to the wealthiest 1.4% of Oregonians in terms of their level of income. And I don't have a recent chart from the DOR, but in 2007, I was supplied with a chart of the then of the 2005 participants' demographics. And that chart showed that for single individuals, the AGI was $77,500. The average AGI. For couples, it was $154,000. And for qualifying widows, I didn't mention widowers, it was $94,500. These are individuals, these are families and individuals who are well above the norm of our society. With only about 1.5% of Oregonians wealthy enough actually to participate in the plan is what we're seeing. It's not that other people don't know about it. It's that they don't have the money. When you're living month to month, you don't stick $100 a month in this plan or $300 a month in the plan. So basically, this is a state grant program that goes to the wealthiest kids who get a college education, and they can go to any accredited university, any place in the country or the world, and there are no requirements that they finish their course of study in a certain course period of time, maintain a grade average, or anything else. And if my granddaughter doesn't go to college, I can pass it to my grandson, and if he doesn't go to college, well, I'll be dead if he doesn't go to college, but if I wanted to, I could actually make myself the beneficiary of my fund, and I could go off to Italy and take an art class. So it's not aimed where we need to be aiming our resources. And in fact, if I were in charge of the world, I would suspend the Oregon the 529 program until the state is on an even keel, because it's benefiting people like my children, my grandchildren, who will most assuredly have the opportunity to go to college if they want. Actually, what happens, and we know this from what's happened to savings in this country at the same time we've added IRAs and all sorts of other tax advantage savings. What's happened is savings has gone down. And so it's those of us who have extra money and would have saved anyway that get the tax advantage rather than the people that we're trying to incent savings for. So I try to do some analysis to see how much we're actually giving to the wealthiest kids. So let's propose that when the child is born, the parents start investing the $4,345 a year that they're currently allowed to invest in a tax-advantaged way. The number is indexed to inflation. I did not try to take that into account. So they can participate in this plan even while their kid is still in college. So they've got 21 years of tax-advantaged $4,000 that they don't pay taxes on. And it's in the fund, and assuming just a 6% return on investment, so that money going in is actually the state's participation in the grandkids or the kids' education is going to be $8,211, more than a kid who is getting an Oregon Opportunity Grant by a few dollars. But then we also have the capital gains that are not taxed. And so when you add that piece in, we're actually creating a gift from the citizens of the state to the wealthiest 1.5% of $15,000 for their college education with no real requirements except they go to an accredited college. And we are not doing anything close to that for the students that aren't going to have this fund or might have a tiny fund and really need the financial aid. And that's why I need to speak against the proposal. I think if they could bring us some proof that an idea like this has worked someplace else, there are 529 plans in many states, then it would be worth looking at. But not now, not when it's going to the wealthiest, and not when we don't have enough money to do what our core job is to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody. Thank you for that perspective. Any questions of the witness? Okay. Thank you very much, Jody.
Okay, we have a few speakers to HJR 6, and why don't we bring up the first three, Steve Buckstein, Joel Fisher, and Eric Knoll. Oh, I'm sorry, Jody, you sent... No, you just had a letter for HJR 6?
No, I have this one. Okay. I still haven't read it to you yet.
Okay.
Thank you.
Welcome, Eric.
Chair Dembro and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. For the record, my name is Eric Knoll, and I am a student at Lynn Benton Community College in Albany, Oregon, here representing the Oregon Student Association and Oregon Community College Student Association, and I will be more than happy to answer questions at the end of my testimony. I do not receive the Oregon Opportunity Grant, so I don't have a personal story to tell you today, but the purpose of my visit is to reinforce the support from our two boards of the Opportunity Initiative and to speak to the importance of the Oregon Opportunity Grant, as well as why we believe this committee and our state legislature should prioritize the Oregon Opportunity Grant through the Opportunity Initiative. We believe that need-based financial aid helps all people in Oregon see post-secondary education as an option. Access to education for all Oregonians is essential for maintaining a qualified workforce. In order to bring business and industry to Oregon, we need a qualified workforce to provide them. And the Opportunity Initiative is a way to give more students access to an education so that they can become a qualified member of the workforce rather than receive no education whatsoever and not become a member of the workforce. The Oregon Opportunity Grant, in our opinion, provides a vital service to Oregonian students by allowing them a point of access to post-secondary education and greatly reducing the amount of debt that they have when leaving college. While it does not reduce their entire load of debt, on average, it does if they receive the entire grant for their 4 years of education, it does remove a large chunk of that debt. We recognize that the Oregon Opportunity Grant is important as tuition continues to rise and as state investment in higher education is slowly declining at a steady rate. The students of OSA and OCCA voted to prioritize the Opportunity Initiative, and honestly, it took very little debate. This was quite the no-brainer for us in terms of providing access to a quality and affordable education in the state of Oregon. About 320,000 Oregonians qualify for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, according to Oregon Student Access Commission statistics. And as Treasurer Wheeler stated, only 2 out of 10 eligible students actually received the grant. That would leave about 250,000 students who are eligible but will not receive the grant. And when we are talking about completion agenda and 40-40-20, 250,000 students who would have more of an access to an education, more of an opportunity to lower their debt and access college is going to, in a way, increase our completion rate and move us toward the 40-40-20 goal. Oregon students prioritize the Opportunity Initiative because we see the Treasurer's plan as a creative solution to a zero-sum funding problem and support a plan that will increase access to education and lower the amount of student debt after college. Again, I don't have a personal story, but throughout this session, most, if not all, of the 30 senators and 60 House members and members of this committee will be visited by students who do have a story about the Opportunity Grant. Most of these students will qualify for the grant but not receive it, and those who do receive it will show you how receiving the grant aided them in their pursuit of higher education to your certificate. I hope throughout this six-month session that you do sit down with them and give them the opportunity to tell you their story. In all, the Treasurer's plan is about creating a stable and long-term fund that will allow students to access a post-secondary education in 30 years. I want to see opportunity, and students in our associations want to see opportunity for students to have quality and accessible education, whether they can afford it or not. And we believe that the Treasurer's plan will meet those ends and provide us a stable resource to fund students' education.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
And it's great to have you back. Mr. Fisher.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher, senior policy analyst with the Oregon Business Association, although I'm not actually senior to anybody there. It's just a title they gave me. Also a former recipient of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Brings me great pleasure to be here testifying with the Oregon Student Association. I was a former board member. And now with OBA, the Oregon Business Association, improving access to higher education is a key pillar of the OBA strategic plan. OBA supports moving Oregon closer to the 40-40-20 goals through a fundamental redesign of the education system. And the Opportunity Initiative is one part of that fundamental redesign. We will be looking for additional information as the session unfolds as to what other capital projects may be affected as key choices are made here in Salem. The high cost of tuition is a major barrier to students in Oregon, and Oregon has relied on an import strategy for educated citizens to meet workforce demands, particularly in the science, technology, engineering, and math fields. This initiative addresses this problem by providing resources to Oregon students to obtain a post-secondary education, and so we are in support of the Opportunity Initiative.
Thank you. Mr. Buckstein.
Thank you, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. I'm Steve Buckstein. I'm senior policy analyst. Actually, I'm senior. I'm the oldest one there. I'm founder of Cascade Policy Institute, a public policy research center in Portland. I'm going to take a different view. I don't think this is a no-brainer, with all due respect. And I want to give you several reasons to think about why you should oppose HJR 6 and the enabling legislation that'll be coming. First, as Professor Richard Vedder, who's author of the book Going Broke by Degree, Why College Costs Too Much, says, higher education prices are rising rapidly because of the predominant role that third-party payments now play, including federal and state support for institutions and for students. When someone else is paying a lot of the bills, students are less sensitive to the price, and the institutions are less sensitive to keeping their costs under control. I know it's hard for students currently to see that. I incurred student loans at Oregon State back when it was quite a bit cheaper, but when there was very much less federal and state support, and so prices were actually lower. So rather than help keep costs down, college costs for students down, and student debt loads for students down, Treasurer Wheeler's proposal will actually likely do just the opposite. We've seen as federal loans, federal support for education, and state support nationwide have increased over the last decades, the actual cost to students hasn't gone down. It's actually gone up, because the costs have gone up much more rapidly than inflation. And even if Treasurer Wheeler's investment assumptions work out, taxpayers with these general obligation bonds will be saddled with debt payments, principal and interest payments for decades into the future, assuming his assumption's right that you won't use the additional earnings, if there are any, to pay down the debt. You'll use it for the opportunity fund. Worse yet, more fundamental, I think, is that there is evidence, and in the testimony I provided you, there are links to some of that evidence, that more government funding of higher education actually translates to slower state economic growth. Repeat that. More funding from government, state and local, actually translates, through a number of regression analyses that have been done over the years, to slower state economic growth compared to states that don't get as much of government funding. That's likely because individuals, in this case students, and taxpayers who are paying the debt, in our case of these general obligation bonds, these individuals know their needs better than you do, or politicians do, or people in the 529 plans do. And so keeping that money that we're talking about going into these general obligation bonds in private hands will actually lead to better economic growth in the state of Oregon. Further, there are other academics such as Charles Murray and Carl Bankstrom, and I've provided you links to some of their work, joined Dr. Vedder in arguing that four-year degrees aren't what they used to be. that's a somewhat of another discussion, but as the percentage of the population have earned four-year degrees, they become less relevant to employers as to understanding what graduates actually know in terms of what skills they actually bring to the job market. It's almost just a point of entry. We won't look at anyone without a bachelor's degree, but if you have a bachelor's degree, we have no idea what your skill set is for meeting our goals as an employer. And so state funding of these four-year degrees, this is not a criticism of vocational or technical training, but of these four-year degrees in general, may simply waste precious resources, again, that taxpayers of Oregon could be using more productively in the economy. But all that said, if your goal of increasing two-year and four-year degrees in the state is a worthy goal, you should step back and not assume that costs are going to keep going up, and look at what some other states are doing to actually dramatically reduce the costs of those 2 and 4 year degrees without saddling their taxpayers with further debt. Arthur Brooks recently noted just the end of last month in the New York Times, and I provided you a link to this article also, that one idea that's gaining traction was actually initially talked about apparently by Bill Gates of Microsoft is the idea of what he called the $10,000 college degree. That's $10,000 for 4 years of direct tuition and book costs, $10,000 for a four-year degree. Several states have actually put out that challenge. Florida, for example, I think all 23 of their public institutions have said they're going to try and design four-year degrees that cost the students $10,000 over 4 years, a dramatic reduction. According to Arthur Brooks, this is exactly the kind of innovation that we would expect, quote, in an industry that's showing every indication of a bubble about to burst. We've seen the housing bubble, we saw the dot-com bubble. Treasurer Wheeler talked to you about the $1 trillion of student debt in this country. A bubble about to burst is what could be happening here. In conclusion, whatever value a college degree has for an individual, and I do agree it has value for the individual, it has more value for the individual than for the surrounding society, according to all the research, and therefore putting more state funds into this kind of a program will simply raise the cost and end up costing taxpayers more than they gain. So with all that, I urge you to reject this and, again, step back and look for other ways to make college more affordable for students in Oregon to benefit the economy without going in what I think is the wrong direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Buckstein. And, you know, I think at some point we may have a hearing on that, those proposals around the $10,000 degree, and I'll ask you to come back at that time. I have some, these are really in the early stages of these proposals. We have absolutely no evidence that they can work, but they're intriguing, and you know, I think it's worth having a discussion around. So thank you. Thank you, all three of you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Rick Johnson.
A question and a comment, if I could.
Okay, please.
Mr. Buxton, just a question. I think your point about third-party payments and how that can contribute to inflation in any kind of I think is accurate. Not only, I think, in regards to higher ed, but I think I would apply that also to the rapid growth of health care costs. But that's another story. Eric, a question for you. What discussions might you have had with your colleagues at OSA about what kind of cost containment measures you all might get behind regarding what's driving the cost of tuition for you and your fellow students?
And if you could make this quick, Eric, and Rep. Johnson, just a week from today, we're going to have some of our hearing time will be spent on that issue of cost drivers, and Jake Kenton will be here to talk about that.
Chair Dembro and Representative Johnson, to clarify, you're asking what discussions have we had about looking at other cost drivers in education. I actually sit as a two-year member of the OCCSA board and don't directly participate in the discussions of the OSA board, although I have attended their meetings and can speak for both boards. I don't have an answer for you at this time, but would be more than happy to follow up with your office to discuss it more in depth.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, I'd like to call up our last panel. This is with respect to House Bill, I'm sorry, Jody, number four. And if you could be quick, Jody, I'm sorry, but we...
I do have other people. I could also come back.
Yeah.
I'll speak fast.
Okay, yeah, speak.
I just noticed that the D's up there are all from the metro area. Is that where all the educated people are? From this building or what? So this...
Jody, if you could identify yourself again.
Oh, Jody Weiser with Taxpayers Oregon. So this legislation is obviously directed at meeting the future needs of our college students. But as designed, it would be hard on the near-term students who actually need the help now. And so basically the solution we suggest is that we take the principal and interest out of the return itself, or even from the bonds that we've got itself, rather than for, I heard a couple weeks ago, 8 years, and today they said 12 years before we actually would get even. And I think that that's an awfully long time when we have kids graduating who can't get jobs that would owe any taxes. You know, it's just too hard a time to do that. Tuition and fees for full-time Oregon students range from about $4,000 at our community colleges to $9,000 or $10,000 at our four-year institutions. And currently, we only provide about $50 million a year in Oregon Opportunity Grants. That's why we're meeting only about 20% of the eligible students' needs. To the idea itself, the bonds are for 30 years, and the assumption is 5.5% interest and a 7% return, which is about what the last 2 years, the return is about what the last 2 years have done. But if you look at the 25-year historic returns, and I'm sorry, I couldn't find 30-year historic returns, the low was for 30 years that market returned only 5.9%, and the high was 17.2%. Both of those numbers were really outliers. You really had to invest at the right moment to get those kinds of returns. The average was mostly between 9 and 12%. And so probably the 7%, if you rely on the past to predict the future, is probably a conservative idea. However, I want to remind you that 30 years ago, HIV and AIDS had just emerged. Sony had introduced the first music CDs. IBM had given us our first PCs, and they were priced at $3,600 in today's dollars. The internet, as we know it, was born. And Oregon, like virtually every other state, taxed all corporations based on the three-legged stool, where it was 30% sales, 30% physical presence, and 30% payroll. So, you know, 30 years, a lot happens in 30 years. And when we look forward, we know we have to share diminishing resources with an increasing population, and that the world is no longer going to be willing for us to take most of the goodies. And we know we are facing global climate change, so I don't think we can actually be feeling confident that this will really make money. But okay, Jody, you know, I ask myself, would I get a mortgage?
Wrap up, Jody,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Would I get a mortgage on my house and invest it right now? You know, my house is paid for. I'm not sure it's a good idea. I'll ask my investment advisor. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I'd like to... Bill, you wanted to speak to this bill?
Yes, please.
Come on up. But be quick, please.
I apologize. I was in a different meeting.
That's great. If you would introduce yourself, please, Bill.
Thank you. Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council, Chair Denbrough Committee. Well, I, right quickly, I just want to let you know that rural Oregon has lost tens and tens of thousands of jobs. My members, those workers in the forestry industry, the secondary workers, they paid their way, the kids to get through college. We didn't have to worry about those people. Now, they can't afford any type of a program, per se. If there's a way that we can help rural Oregon, the school systems, the high school students aren't getting the education they need to apply for a scholarship. The better teachers leave. I hate to say this, but the better teachers leave. A family of four making $23,000, $28,000 a year is just 25% above poverty, federal. They can't afford to put any money for their children. If we could, jobs, if we could just create some jobs in rural Oregon, I urge you all to help the governor work through this timber management plan that we've been working on for 20 years and put our people back to work in rural Oregon. We can't put them all back, but let's maintain the jobs that we got there today. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks. Okay, our final panel is with respect to House Bill 2304, and that's Tracy Gibbs and Marcia Kelly. Thank you very much, both of you.
For the record, my name is Tracy Gibbs, and I am a current Portland State University student from Portland, Oregon. I wanted to lend a voice to the pressing need for funding for higher public education. I applaud the legislature's commitment to examining this issue. There is a near total agreement that the Oregon higher education funding needs to be a top priority. However, House Bill 2304 does need to be reexamined. The assumption that all college students will have an earned taxable liability is highly questionable. At best, most college students like me will have a part-time job during college as well as outside of college. And even after college, postgraduates will most likely be non-refundable low-wage income earners who won't have any tax liabilities. And for all the 6 years that I've been in college, I, like many of my friends, like I stated before, have had a part-time job during this, and I have had no tax liabilities. And under the conditions of this proposal, my friends and I would not be eligible for this tax credit. And this proposed tax credit disqualifies us from not only that, but we also have to work for the cost of living, and since few of us are more likely to get through even 3 to 5 years of college, we would also be disqualified based on the timetable that Representative Reed has given for this proposal. And the potentiality of two credits of $125 for a community college student or four tax credits of $250 for a four-year institution is very likely to unlikely to provide motivation, like he said before, particularly now when many of us students know that we will be really lucky to even have a job that will provide us with a tax liability upon graduation. Education tax credits can offset those costs. However, these costs, the cost of education is so high at this point that the legislature needs to re-support the Oregon Opportunity Grant through the Oregon Opportunity Initiatives for all Oregon students. And to give a picture of how diminutive the tax credit would cover the cost of college, my last tuition bill, this current term, I am on my final term at PSU, and my current tuition bill was $1,807 with a total of $427 in student fees, a degree application fee, and books. And I've only signed up for a part-time status of 10 hours this term. And this proposed tax credit would only cover just fewer than 15% of just my current tuition bill. This proposal also ignores the fact that most students don't even know about the current tax credits available. The tax credits are a nebulous and intricate system that most postgraduates can't even understand. And I can't even imagine that the average postcollegiate would fully know about the current tax credits that are available. This proposal would be a very narrow and obscure non-refundable tax credit that would require not only a new set of rules to be written, but revenue agents and tax preparers to be trained, all for an unproven stimulus. And while a largely underfunded and well-known program is just waiting for more funding, and that is the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And like Treasurer Wheeler stated before, it is woefully inadequate as it is right now, as it is only available to 25% of the students who need grants. And therefore, I urge the committee to reconsider House Bill 2304. If you have extra money to spend, give it to the Oregon Opportunity Grant or fund higher education as a whole so that Oregon students can have the quality education that they deserve. I'd like to thank Chair Denborough again and the members of the committee for having me here to speak, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about my testimony after we are done.
Thank you. Marcia.
Chair Denborough and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women of Oregon. In the future, I'll use AUW, if that's okay with you. But to let you know, because there are new faces here, AUW was founded in 1881 by fewer than 12 women in Boston, and their goal was to help other women get college degrees by helping them with their funding. Over the years, AUW has expanded. We do research. We do fund about $3 million of post-baccalaureate aid to women on an annual basis. We have 100,000 members nationally, about 2,000 in Oregon, branches in Lakeview, and a new one in La Grande. So we are not just a I-5 organization. We also sponsor the National Conference for College Women and Student Leaders. I need to talk to you about that. And also have a training next weekend called the Lecture to help women get leadership to run on college campuses with the hope that there will be more people sitting up there on the dais. This is an all-male committee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh. Yes, we've noticed.
We do research, too. We are here in opposition to House Bill 2304. There are equity problems with it that have been touched upon. It doesn't account for people who are trying to go to school part-time. It doesn't account for people who are returning to school if they haven't graduated from high school within 5 years. It is not a lot of money individually, but collectively it could be a lot of money. If you take the recipients of the Opportunity Grant in this current biennium, about 60,000 plus, and you broke those into half of them doing AAs and half of them doing BAs or BSs, and then you multiply the tax credit, you actually come out with real money. And that real money should be spent on something that is going to aid us in the future and not necessarily real money for people who've been able to go to school and get their degree within 5 years or their AA degree within 3 years. That just is inequitable to have that sort of a qualification. The real money, I calculated out, is about $38 million a biennium. The Opportunity Grant could be served, or we could actually really look toward the future and spend that money on Oregon Pre-K Head Start, where we are woefully underfunded. Only 78% of Oregon's four-year-olds and 86% of Oregon's three-year-olds are in Pre-K Head Start or special education, according to the latest Rutgers look at early education in the states. And I think that that sort of expenditure or the opportunity grant expenditure would serve that $38 million serve the state much more if we're looking down the road, rather than a minimal tax credit for individuals, but collectively a lot of money. And I think my figures are probably low, because I was only looking at recipients of Oregon Opportunity and thinking that they would all get through school. But at 25%, 20 to 25% of people wanting to go to school, that I think is a low figure. So think about the $38 million. It could be in one biennium.
Thank you very much, both of you. Unless there are pressing questions, yes, thank you. I think you both made your points very well. So with that, I'm going to close the concurrent public hearings on HCR 6, HB 2299, and HB 2304. And briefly, colleagues, I am going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee measures. We do have one measure to introduce, and it's actually as a result of an error. On Wednesday, we introduced one of the LCs that we introduced was the wrong LC.
That's
a bad sign.
It had already been introduced as a personal bill, apparently. So that action has been removed from the record. Following is the LC that was intended to be sent to us and have us introduce. And that measure is LC 1465, dated February 1st, 2013. So I would seek a motion to do the right thing.
Mr. Chair, I move we do the right thing and move that LC 1465, dated 2-1-13, be introduced as a committee bill.
Great. Chair Huffman has moved that LC 1465, dated February 1st, 2013, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion?
What appropriate to go on the record against doing the right thing, is it?
Not in this instance, sir. Is there any objection to our adopting this as a committee bill? Hearing none, this LC will be introduced as a committee bill. And I will close the work session at this time, and I will open an information hearing on the Oregon Student Access Commission. Call up Bob Rue. And Bob, I'm afraid that our time has gotten beyond us, so you're not going to be able to do more than introduce yourself and just say a few things about OSAC, and we promise to bring you back soon to give us more substance.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chair Dembro and representatives. For the record, my name is Bob Brew, and I'm the Interim Executive Director for the Oregon Student Access Commission. OSAC has been around since 1959. Our goal as an agency is dedicated solely to helping students plan for and pay for college. And in order to do that, we have three main focuses. We're the administrative agency for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which has gotten quite a bit of discussion this morning. I wish we had time to get into that, but hopefully a future time. We also are an administrator for scholarships from private donations. We currently administer 450 different funds that students can access through a single online application. This represents about $16 million of private money going to Oregon students each year, about 3,900 recipients each year. Our third program is Aspire. This is a mentoring program that is in high schools, middle schools, and community colleges across the state that pairs volunteer mentors coordinated at the site level and then on the broader state level by OSAC to help students think about post-secondary plans for high school, whether that's a certificate, whether that's a two-year degree, associate's degree, four-year degree, medical school, whatever. It's open to all comers. And I have included some slides that you're welcome to go through, and that's my elevator speech, so I'm available for any questions.
Thanks, Bob. And why don't you just quickly tell us what Aspire is? It's a program some of us know very well and are proud of, but perhaps you could say something about it.
Aspire is a great program. And the way it works is you'll have at individual high schools a site and coordinator that gets a small stipend, a lot like an athletic coach might, to coordinate a crew of volunteers. And these volunteers are trained specifically in working with students to help them think about what they need to do in order to pursue some higher education. That may be, you know, for first-time college goers envisioning that this is a possibility. flexibility. But for students that already know they're going to go on to college, this might include, you know, helping them complete applications, keeping on track with their deadlines, and so on. So these volunteers are the backbone. The site coordinators provide the coordination in the area. They're right in the schools. In some cases, these are retired teachers. They might be counselors working extra hours. They might be just community citizens that are involved with this. And then at the OSAC level, this whole statewide network for 140 sites, more or less, is coordinated by 4 FTE. It's a very low-cost, very effective program. If you look in your slides, you'll see that just five schools, I think it's about slide 11 or so, or slide 11 shows you the current Aspire site locations, and slide 12 shows you how effective this program is with minimal investment on the part of the state. We hope to eventually be in every school district in the state. We're such an effective program at such a great value to the citizens, and it really works.
Thank you, Bob. Anybody have any quick questions of Bob? Just Bob, one of the things that we're going to be wrestling with this session, of course, is the governance issues around post-secondary, and OSAC is a key element there. In terms of reporting relationships, how does OSAC work currently?
Yes, Representative Dembo, thank you. OSAC currently has a 7-member board appointed by the governor. This has two student representatives on there. The other 5 are, many of them have backgrounds in financial aid or college administration, so they're very familiar. Under the governor's proposed plan, OSAC would become part of the Department of Post-Secondary Education. We would be in there with the community colleges and workforce development. We'd join the Office of Degree Authorization, the Office of Private Career Schools, and then probably part of the OUS Chancellor's Office.
Yes, Rep. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. I have not taken the time to look through all the slides here, but on one that you called out, slide 12, it shows the increase in college-going rates over a period ranging from 4 to 9 years at these 5 different schools, and they do each go up. We have seen general increases in the number of percentage of people going to college during this time frame. Do you know what? Do you have a control? What's the change in a group of comparable schools over the same time period that did not have Aspire programs?
Representative Dimble, Representative Harker, thank you for the question. We don't have a control group. We haven't always done a really good job of tracking that prior to arriving on the scene. So,
okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, great. And just one final question, Bob. You know, we talked about desire to look at the effectiveness of the Student Opportunity Grant, and is anything happening currently? There was talk about putting money into the budget to help with a study of the effectiveness. Is that in the governor's recommended budget?
I couldn't speak to that. I've not heard that, but that's something that we're very interested in. It's always traditionally been a need-based grant, and particularly in the last few years, there's been little or no predictability, quite frankly, as to whether a student who got it 1 year would get it the next year. In fact, when we looked at a cohort of 30,000 students that got the opportunity grant 6 years ago, we could only find 500 that had received the grant each of those for each of 4 years. So the unpredictability of the grant has made that particularly troublesome, but it's something that we're interested in looking at. We're a small agency. We don't have the research tools to do that work.
Great. Thank you. Yes, Rep. Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Bob, you probably haven't been tagging on to that, been able to delve too much into following the money to find out how much Oregon Opportunity Grant money has been put out there over the years that did not end up turning into any form of a degree or...
Thank you, Representative Dembo, Representative Huffman. We don't have that information, particularly because I think I was trained as an economist, and there's this concept in economics called ceteris paribus, holding everything else constant while you look at the one variable. And our Oregon Opportunity Grant only represents about 10% of the cost of education. And so it's really hard to separate if a student got $1,500 3 years ago, what impact that $1,500 had on them continuing the next year, provided that they got it again. We don't really have that information. That's something that we'd like to work with the researchers at OUS to kind of see if we can suss some of that out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. That's one of the things I would like to see is, you know, if you're going to invest $1,500 in something, most of us, if we put $1,500 in a Fidelity account or something, you kind of keep track of how it grows or where it goes or what happens. And I would have hoped that the managers of Oregon Opportunity would have had a system set up to follow the money and say, is our investment mm-hmm. paying off in that we're getting people degrees, not just some education, although I've in the last couple of days heard the argument that any additional education is better than nothing. Now, hard to argue with that, but at the end of the day, 40-40 is looking at degrees, and if we're putting a lot of money out there, as we are, and it's not ultimately getting us to degrees or the students to degrees and improving their lives, enhancing their income, et cetera, and so on, then right. Got to have that talk.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you raising that point, and it is something that we're going to want to pay attention to. I will say that in this, as in so many other things, Oregon is not alone. And this is a national conversation that's going on around the connection between need-based aid and outcomes, completion. And there's some research that's starting to happen on a national level. And I think we're going to have to follow that. And I don't know, Bob, if any of your people are familiar with any of that research. But, you know, the more we can become aware of that and share it with the committee, we will do so.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colleagues, thank you for your patience. I'm going to close this informational hearing on OSAC, reiterate my commitment to Bob to bring him back. And with that, I will close this hearing. We are adjourned.
I told Representative Johnson, my self-esteem was pretty much crushed. I am now an uneducated old white guy.
Rural white guy.
Which clearly translates to